And welcome back. Another episode. A very happy new year to each and every one of the hundreds of you who are listening to this podcast now. I mean, 2021 kicked off with a monstrous bang, and it's increasingly looking like a rocky ride up ahead too. And on that note, I wanted to start this episode with a plea. If you are struggling with anything at all right now, do not, I repeat, do not suffer in silence. You will not be a burden. You are not an idiot for feeling this way. And you're most certainly not alone. The hardest part about struggling, I think, is accepting you're struggling and reaching out for help. I've been there, done it before. It's so difficult. However, there is support for you. There is help. And I promise you, there is light at the end of the tunnel. This will pass. We also have huge numbers of people who listen regularly who are just interested in mental health and want to understand people's minds better. So here's another plea to you directly. To those of you who don't struggle but want to help in this entire area, please let's rally round in this time of crisis and reach out to your friends. Check in on your men. Ask them how they are. But more importantly, don't just leave it there. Ask them how they are mentally. A simple, "How are you mentally, mate?" is a great way to get onto this subject. This is a question I get asked a lot. How do you even approach it with people? Because it's kind of an awkward subject to talk about. I know, but it doesn't need to be if we approach it the right way. We need you, we need everyone right now to look after one another. I promise you that whilst COVID-19 has been utterly devastating in so many ways, the knock-on effects of COVID on people's mental health is causing a deeper and heartbreaking parallel pandemic in mental health. And unless we open our eyes fully to the harsh realities of it, understand people and this area better, and take responsibility for it, we are walking into an unmitigated disaster. Once again, we're very, very proud to be working with men's health brand, Cornerstone, to help push men's health and men's mental health. I got sent my box recently, and I must say I'm absolutely in love. Cornerstone are your all-in-one men's health subscription box with a wide range of tailored products from shaving, hair care, what else? Moisturizing. Let me look at my box actually now. Right, yeah, moisturizing, dental care, and also, amazingly, sexual health. They have genuinely got everything a man needs to look and feel amazing every day. It should be the cornerstone of your day. Do you see what I did there? I like it. As a Rut listener, you get £10 off your first box by going to cornerstone.co.uk/Rut. That's www.cornerstone.co.uk/Rut. Claim yours now. My next guest, and to start 2021, almost said 2020 then actually, but to start 2021 off on with a different, the first kind of episode I've done of this manner actually with this type of guest. My next guest has just released an absolutely brilliant book, which was released on the 7th of January. It's out now in Amazon, and I was very lucky to be sent an early copy of it, and I read it in about 3 days. It was so good. He's released an absolutely brilliant book on his battle with clinical depression called Mending the Mind, The Art and Science of Treating Clinical Depression. He's an absolutely brilliant columnist and lead writer for the Times newspaper, and he previously worked at the Bank of England and in private equity, working on security indexes and fixed derivatives. But very recently, he seemingly overnight went from a fully functioning working member of society to a complete depressive mess. And he tells his story on this podcast, and we explore the fascinating routes he took to understanding and treating clinical depression. Welcome to The Rut, Oliver Cam. As always, please leave all judgment at the door. Mr. Oliver Cam, how are you?
Good morning.
Welcome to The Rut.
Thank you, my pleasure.
You're in what looks like sunny Clapham, I can see.
I'm in leafy, verdant Clapham in lockdown, yes.
How has lockdown been for you?
Well, I'm slightly guilty that it has... I feel slightly guilty that it has not been arduous at all. But my position is very different from that of so many others. I have the good fortune to be not only gainfully employed, but inundated with work, living in a nice part of London with plenty of greenery where I can walk and in pleasant accommodation. So many other people are worried for their livelihoods, living in cramped or even substandard accommodation, without access to green spaces, and perhaps in tense relationships, family relationships, or dysfunctional or even abusive partnerships. There is no question but that lockdown has imposed many, many hardships, both economic and psychological, and those are tied together. That's not an argument against lockdown, which is a point I make in my writings, but it is a fact. And for me, apart from the fact that I miss my friends, I'm slightly guilty to find it quite a congenial experience. For most people, this is not the case at all.
No, I completely agree. I actually, when lockdown was first announced, we got off a plane from Bali, and I was on the back end of being suicidal. And I saw it as this wonderful opportunity, which I forced myself to think about, to slow down, to speed up. And that's something now that actually I kind of live and die by when I'm in a rut, is really slowing down. And it's only a month ago where I started to slip back into my latest bout of depression, really. And I'm out the other side of it. And I changed my to-do list from this to-do list of things I'd like to achieve with the podcast, but also other work I'm doing in mental health too. Right, let's get up and brush my teeth. Let's get up and eat. And let's get up and put some clothes on. And that's been remarkable. Before we go into your story and your brilliant, brilliant new book, which is going to be published in January, right?
January the 7th, available right from fine bookstores everywhere.
There we go. You've got your ear to the ground within British mainstream politics, and I assume politics worldwide too, across many different public figures, both journalists, bankers, in the media, etc. What have you been hearing in lockdown in terms of people who are beginning to register potential poor mental health symptoms? Has there been any discussion between your circles, the epicenter that you live in, of people coming to you being like, Oliver, I'm struggling. What is this?
I haven't directly had people come to me to talk about their mental health, but I'm very keen that the stigma of such discussion should be dispelled.
Right.
There is no doubt in my mind that the issue of mental health will become and must become more prominent in 2021 because of the extraordinary psychological circumstances in which literally billions of people throughout the world have been in some form of lockdown. Now, this is not comparable to a great national trauma like wartime. And there have been many analogies with the experience of the Blitz. One very distinguished psychiatrist made the point to me while he was reading my book in draft that during the Blitz, the government of the day made a deliberate decision to keep cinemas open. It sounds rather extraordinary. These were sitting targets, and there were thousands of direct hits on cinemas. But the government of the day took the decision that the social bond was so important in maintaining national morale, would have been the phrase, that it was a course that needed to be taken. Now, lockdown is a different experience. Of course, we don't have the threat of aggression from a military power, but we do have a public health crisis in which mental health is very much part of the nexus of decision making. Now, the critics of lockdown, let's call them, I don't particularly like the term, but let's call them lockdown skeptics, as they describe themselves, have made the point that not only is there a big economic cost, which President Trump, among others, has commented on, but there is a big psychological toll as well. And this point is not wrong. It is absolutely correct.
It's correct.
It is absolutely correct. There is a big psychological toll of isolation, of not being able to see friends and family, of not being able to even get on a train or a cycle and change the scenery. That's not an argument against lockdown. My argument in the book is that just as there's no way of avoiding an economic cost of a public health crisis, there's no real way of avoiding a psychological one either. COVID-19, we now know, has it's not only a disease affecting the respiratory system, it's a multi-system illness, which also has a direct neurological impact. There are reports of confusion and seizures among those who have been affected, those who've been infected by COVID-19. And it is very likely that, just as happened in the global influenza pandemic of 1918-1920, which cost around 50 million lives, it's very likely that there will be a rise in the incidence of psychiatric disorder. And as a result of this public health crisis, we're talking, James, in the week when there's been some emerging, hopefully good news about the development of a vaccine. Let's hope that that is realized. But even on the best case scenario, it will take a long time for a vaccine to be distributed in such numbers as to have a big effect in easing lockdown. And all of these factors mean that mental health is a particularly pressing issue in a public health crisis unlike any for at least a generation, and possibly for a century.
There was a report out yesterday. It might be yesterday or the day before. My other half, she ran in and said, James, you must look at this. And I read it, and there was reports suggesting that actually 30% of COVID-19 sufferers are reporting or experiencing symptoms of depression or psychological trauma. That is fascinating. Whether this disease is causing such poor physical symptoms, and also we're looking at intense fatigue. I mean, I had COVID in March and it was unlike anything I've ever had before. I've not been particularly ill, mind, in my life, but it was the worst flu I've ever had. And funnily enough, off the back of that, yeah, depression and anxiety was the mainstay of my summer this year. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you, but I wonder why COVID-19 is causing psychological problems.
Your partner is absolutely right to have picked up on this story. It's a story that is based on a paper in The Lancet, the medical journal. And I can't remember the figure, but that sounds about right. There have been many reports of psychological illness, and these are illnesses, depression and anxiety, as well as the issues that public health officials pointed to in the early stages of the crisis of mental health issues arising from bereavement and grief and isolation and substance abuse and domestic violence. There is now clinical evidence, as you rightly say, of a substantial increase, an appreciable increase in the rate of depression and anxiety, two closely related conditions that are not the same. Depression is a very specific illness. Anxiety is a sort of umbrella term for a number of disorders. But yes, COVID-19 is, as I say, a multi-system illness. It's not. It's definitely not like the flu. It's definitely not even like a bad case of the flu. It's a multi-system illness which directly threatens mental health, as well as the physical impact, the impact on the respiratory system, which is what has sadly caused many, many deaths, hundreds of thousands of deaths.
Your book, Mending the Mind, you very kindly sent to me to read 2 weeks ago, and I've flown through it because it was absolutely brilliant. It's in the book you talk, and I want to get onto the book in a little bit, but I just want to get some context into Oliver Cam as a person. But interestingly, focusing in on the book quickly, you're quite critical of your first encounter with a therapist, in which she tries to dive deep into exploring basically your history, your experiences mm-hmm. growing up. I want to do that quickly. So I'm gonna put my tin hat on. But you were born to relatively well-known parents, right? Anthony Cam, Anthea Bell. Your father was a cricketer, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He was a very fine sportsman. In his youth, he played county cricket for Middlesex. And my mother, Anthea Bell, was a prominent and eminent literary figure. She was a translator, and I had the good fortune to have to grow up in a house with books, and I was very close to my mother, who was a brilliant literary mind, and I was very fortunate in that respect. I had constant mental encouragement and from my parents.
Did you, coming from a background where you've got two pretty successful parents in itself, did you feel any expectation growing up to, I suppose, evolve into somebody of stature, or somebody who's going to make something of themselves? Did you feel that?
No, not at all. My parents divorced when I was 10, and I loved my father very, very much. But I was more mentally attuned to my mother, with whom I lived while I was growing up. And On the contrary, she was so concerned not to be an overbearing parent that sometimes I wished she would give me sterner advice and recommendations than she actually did. She wanted me to be happy. She was a wonderful mother, as well as a great intellect, and I gained an enormous amount from her. But I had no sense of being told this is the path we have mapped out for you. Indeed, I did something quite different from anyone else in my family. When I left university, I did postgrad at London University, and I joined the Bank of England as a graduate trainee, and I worked in the city for a long time. It seems a long time ago now, but my journalism, I've been a leader writer and a columnist at the Times for 12 years now. I joined in 2008. And my family all thought, in retrospect, writing is what he was cut out to do.
Yeah.
And indeed, I enjoyed my time in the city, but I'm in my first and only job in journalism. I hope it will be my last job in journalism. I've been there 12 years now, I enjoy it hugely.
I think my father hoped the same. I mean, we come from a long background in journalists, and my dad was at The Sun at its peaks. But none of us have followed that path, and none of us ever wish to. I enjoy writing, and writing a book I'm writing at the moment on my mental health and my journey, but also my blog. You studied PPE at Oxford. What were your goals and ambitions back then?
Do you know, I didn't really have them, which is no great reflection on my ambition.
Nor shame or surprise, actually.
I had a range of intellectual interests, and I like to think that...
Like what?
You're quite right to say that the first degree I took was PPE, philosophy, politics, and economics, which is often criticised as a sort of magpie type degree. And the fact that recent public figures, such as David Cameron,
including several prime studied, ministers, yes,
including several prime ministers. Prime ministers naturally attract a lot of criticism, and one of the criticisms directed particularly at David Cameron is he didn't have the sort of deep insight that would have allowed him to predict, for example, all the constitutional ructions that arose from his decision to go for a Brexit referendum. But let's leave that on one side, because we're not talking about politics.
Politicians are criticised because all political careers end in failure, bar arguably Nigel Farage.
Well, I guess I think that sort of recalls an observation of Enoch Powell.
And,
I don't think that's right. I think one can say that there are politicians who, for all their idiosyncrasies and all their failings, have done things that are not only hugely beneficial but historic. I mean, obviously Churchill in wartime, but also Lloyd George for his founding of the welfare state, Attlee for having, among other things, cemented this country's place in the Western Alliance at a time that Stalin really did aim for the occupation of the whole of Europe. I won't go more recently because it's more difficult to judge more recent prime ministers. But anyway, you asked me about the range of intellectual interests. Well, I'm interested in science and I'm interested in culture. I have the good fortune to have a job as a writer where... and particularly in the role of writing leaders or editorials for the Times, I have the opportunity to communicate the stuff I know to an intelligent, non-specialist audience. And in the book that you've so kindly referred to, I do cover a lot of ground in a number of areas, both in the sciences and in the arts. And yeah, I have the good fortune in my job to have got to know not just experts in technical fields, but world authorities in technical fields, like linguistics. I've written a book before on popular linguistics, which I know is intellectually robust. I know that it holds water because it hasn't been torn apart by real experts on the subject. Because I made sure that I checked everything I wrote with world-leading academics, and I believe that the same will be true of my book on mental health, because it has been checked very carefully, and I have consulted at length with authorities on the subject. That's what I regard as an absolutely crucial role of my work as a journalist. I have opinions, I have views, I express them in writing, but when I deal with a technical issue, I'm duty bound to make sure that I get the facts right. And to get the facts right, I make sure that I consult with real authorities in the field whose work I want to learn from, and the discovery of which I wish to make better known to a non-specialist audience.
I want to touch briefly on culture at the Bank of England. And was there any I suppose, exposure to anybody suffering potential mental health issues? And was it discussed? I can't imagine it was.
No, I have no recollection of it whatsoever. It was a... it was a very good place to work. I learnt a lot. I had a tremendous education, professional education, in the principles of finance, of applied economics, of the capital markets. My mentor at the bank when I was a graduate trainee was Andrew Bailey, who has gone on to be governor. We became close friends and have remained so over nearly 35 years now. And I learned a great deal from him. But it was another culture that length of time. There were not many women in senior positions at that time. There's a much better representation of women in public service, in senior positions in public service now. Tiny things like the fact that people smoked in the office then. It's a different sort of cultural background. But I don't recall any reference at all to mental health. And there were certainly one or two people who, looking back, were appear to me to have been in some difficulties, and I, to my discredit, I didn't really take note of it at the time, but it stays in my mind.
Why did you leave? Because you had a relatively significant career change, I suppose. It's not most dismissive career change ever, but. Leaving the Bank of England for the Times, what prompted the career change?
Well, I didn't leave the Bank of England for the Times. I stayed a few years at the Bank of England. I joined as a graduate trainee. I worked there for a few years and learned a great deal. But I left the bank to join... I became interested in the financial markets. I left the bank to work as an equities fund manager, and then I went to the other side of the securities industry. I was an equity strategist for HSBC Securities, covering the European stock markets in the run-up to the euro, and then I helped set up an investment bank in a pan-European investment bank that was an arm of Commerzbank, the German commercial bank. And eventually, I gave up the city to be a writer. I was invited to join the Times One of the best jobs in journalism as a leader writer for the Times, when I was
I'm a very proud subscriber.
In my 40s. Thank you. When I was in my 40s, I wasn't expecting to be offered it. I leapt to the chance to leave the city. And immediately, this was in 2008, immediately the entire Western banking system collapsed. So I had a subject to cover. In the great financial crash. I joined the Times in July 2008, and a few weeks later, Lehman Brothers, the US investment bank, collapsed, and financial markets collapsed. So I had the opportunity to change career for circumstances that would never occur now. I was one of the early political bloggers, just as a hobby, and people noticed it. The Times asked me if I would like to contribute freelance comment pieces. The Guardian, under the comment editorship of Seamus Milne, who went on to other things, asked the same thing. And so I wrote, just as a hobby, freelance opinion pieces for a few places, The Times, The Guardian, Prospect, one or two other well-known periodicals. And after a few years doing that, I was offered a full-time post at The Times and was very fortunate to be offered it and very glad to take it.
I want to move on to your experience with depression and obviously mending the mind. There's several, the book is split into several parts. The first part, as I read it, was split into your kind of exploration into the understanding behind mental health illness, mental illness and depression. And then the kind of the second part is your exploration into living with it, how you dealt with it and how you overcame it. And then obviously moved into the arts and sciences. Oliver, tell me what happened? Where did this all start?
Yes, I mean, the book, there are a lot of memoirs of depression, and my book is not one of those. It's intended to be, it's intended to give my story, but primarily to be an exploration of the subject from the standpoint of modern science. And also, my argument is because our understanding of the mind from a scientific standpoint is reliable but still rudimentary, because neuroscience is still in its infancy. I also wanted to relate what sufferers through the ages, not least artists and poets, have said of the ailment. My experience of depression was very sudden, very unexpected. I had no history of mental illness, nor any that I know of in my family. And as we know, there is some susceptibility to depression genetically. There is some evidence of that.
I don't know if you've read Alistair Campbell's new book.
I have read Alistair's book, yes. Yeah. And, it's a very moving account of how he has coped with recurrent bouts of depression in a very public role. My book is different in that I'm not as well known as Alistair is, and my observations of depression are intended to be a description of what it's like to be mentally ill, because it's very unlike any other experience I've had. It's weird.
You talk about it being sudden.
Yeah,
this arguably for me was one of the most fascinating parts of the book. Was when I was reading it, I was trying to get my head around how it's almost as if you woke up one morning and the struggle was real. The events shaped you forgot your address getting into a cab. That's how it seemingly started.
Yes.
But are you really saying that from memory loss, we there was no signs that you could suggest before that event where you get into that cab and you're like, I don't know where I live?
There were, in retrospect, there should have been signs. My realization of depression was very sudden because my mind just stopped functioning. I literally forgot my home address, and it just wouldn't come back. And this was unusual because my memory is something that I rely on professionally. In retrospect, I think the exigencies of life had borne down on me for a long time. They weren't particularly extreme cases of, well, they weren't at all extreme cases of suffering or distress. I merely suffered the sort of setbacks and disappointments that punctuate any normal, ordinary life.
And what were those? What were those? Because you described some of the failures you felt in the book with relationships, and in particular, yes, a poignant note about your death of your father. I mean, that it seemed like you were constantly, I suppose, self-flagellating.
Yes, that's right. I in the middle period of life, it's very common. I refer to some of the economic and social science and psychological literature on this point. It's very common to encounter thwarted ambitions and disappointments. The idea of a midlife crisis is a bit of a cliche, but it actually conforms to the social science literature. There really is a dip in midlife that's very common, has been mapped across all advanced industrial economies. We tend to have a midlife dip. Not everyone, but it's very noticeable in the charts. And mine did come upon me, not out of the blue, but because of a weight of, I suppose, disappointments as to how my life had turned out. Like many other people, I had relationship issues and marital issues that did not turn out as I would have wished. I suffered the bereavement of my father at a time when I was particularly acutely sensitive to them and felt that I hadn't spoken to him enough. I had no... And the issue of marital failure, I think it's fair to say marital failure, and relationship issues weighed upon me. The responsibilities of single parenthood weighed upon me, and my loneliness became ever more acute. It was partly self-inflicted. I barely saw my friends my closest friends for around a decade, and quite suddenly, everything seemed to because I was commuting long distances and had the responsibility of single parenthood, and got myself into the title of your podcast is The Rut, and I think that effectively encapsulates where I was. I was coping, but I was not in a happy frame of mind. It was not, as I thought of it, some sort of crisis. It was just a numbing disappointment that life had not turned out as I would have wished it to be and as I had expected it might be. And suddenly, everything just seemed to collapse in on itself. And I eventually got the diagnosis that it was severe clinical depression, which was a revelation to me because I had no conception of what this was like.
Before we dive into that, I want to just, if you may, and I'm sure you will, but I want to understand what it was really like inside your mind. Let's say, okay, well, the the taxi incident described in the book happens. Okay. Yeah. And then there's a period of time where you don't get a diagnosis of clinical depression. I'm not sure how long it is. But what was kind of, I suppose, what was the cycle of self-flagellation in your mind? What were the triggers day to day? Because you actually describe in the second part of the book, this ordeal every single day of waking up, getting up, getting out the door was like running a marathon. It was like a war. So what was the cycle of self-flagellation?
Yes, the experience of not being able to remember my home address was quite striking. Mm-hmm. And that was when I realized there must be a problem. When I eventually got home on a bus that I recognized, the first thing I did was just go to bed, and I didn't move for around 24 hours. I sent an email to my closest friends indicating some distress, and they had never seen this. They had never had this sort of communication from me before and realized there was something wrong. And it was a little while later that I got the diagnosis of clinical depression. I tried to carry on and realized that I was not in the correct frame of mind, and my friends observed it too. You mentioned earlier my initial, when I realized that there was a big problem, I went to talk to my employers because I realized that I was not operating normally. I was not capable of carrying out my professional duties. I just couldn't write properly. I could barely string a sentence together. And for a full-time salaried employee of a national newspaper, this is pretty serious. I had an initial abortive experience of what's known as psychodynamic psychotherapy.
Could you explain that? Because actually that's something yes. I was interested in reading, because you're very critical of it, understandably,
yes.
From your experience. But what is that?
Yes. There are different forms of psychological therapy, many different forms. The particular type of therapy that I had in the first instance, and that I'm critical of in some circumstances, not in others, I'll come on to that, is known as psychodynamic psychotherapy. It is a type of talking therapy that has its roots in the work of Sigmund Freud and psychoanalysis, though it's not the full-blown psychoanalysis where you engage in an open-ended inquiry into a subject's early life and distant memories. Apart from anything else, that just takes a lot of time. And for someone who's suffering mental illness, you don't have time. You want to help them get better. Well, psychodynamic psychotherapy is a type of therapy that, as I say, has its roots in the work of Freud, and it hypothesizes that the key to mental disorder lies in unresolved conflicts in one's past. And to get better in a sustained way requires an investigation of those memories in order to uncover what is causing the psychological torment. Now, I had this experience, I had this type of treatment, which I recount in the book, which was not appropriate for me, did not work, and indeed made the problem worse in two respects. First, the fact that the psychodynamic psychotherapist who I saw certainly found me an exasperating individual and made this, without any intention, made this known to me, which did compound my conviction that I was a failure in life. And second,
right, I see.
She did actively dissuade me from seeking other types of therapy. And I have no doubt that she meant this very generously and very well. She believed that other types of psychological therapy were a sticking plaster on a wound that would not deal with the underlying problem. Mm. Now, for both those reasons, I think her approach was damaging, and the clinical guidelines about treatment of depression, the official clinical guidelines suggest that psychodynamic therapy is not shown to work with cases of mood disorder. My view, having read these guidelines and had this experience, is that psychodynamic psychotherapists are, I'm certain, as a profession, good-hearted people who genuinely seek the welfare of their clients, who have studied hard on their various courses in counseling and therapy, and who are, for many people, beneficial. They can be beneficial in two ways. First, for people who aren't really ill, but seek a confidant to discuss the problems of life, relationship difficulties, failures, thwarted ambitions, disappointments that we all have from time to time. And there are also people, psychiatrists have stressed this to me, there are people, there's a particular type of psychodynamic therapy practiced in this country called object relations therapy, which is associated with a psychoanalyst, an Austrian, British-Austrian psychoanalyst of, maybe the 1920s, I think, called Melanie Klein? I think it's Melanie Klein. I'll double check that when we're off this podcast. Which stresses the role of relationships in mood disorders. Now, that might sound commonsensical. To me, it does sound commonsensical. But it's the type of psychodynamic psychotherapy that for people who may never have had a significant positive relationship any time in their life, who may have been neglected or even abused as children and have never managed to form a positive relationship, that type of approach by a kind and sympathetic person may be highly beneficial. But for mood disorders in general, for anxiety, for depression, the scientific evidence that this type of approach works is just not there. And it's tempting to say, well, whatever works for the patient is valid, but that can't be right. Mood disorders, mental disorders, psychiatric disorders are a scientific question. They're a real illness. And there are evidence-based approaches that do work. My book is intended to make these better known, both the talking therapies and the pharmacological, neuropharmacological therapies and treatments that do work. The type of approach that psychodynamic therapy uses, I think, is not appropriate, certainly did not do me any good, and it was quite damaging, and this is why I'm critical, it was quite damaging to attempt to keep me from finding evidence-based, science-based treatments that did work.
I suppose my one question when I was reading through that section of the book was, what if due to one's memories or one's experiences of trauma, unrest, of disease, of uncomfortability in their past, that this essentially triggers and causes, I suppose, certain thoughts, which leads to depressive and apparent immediate depressive causation in the here and now. But that was the only question mark I had, because I speak to a lot of people on this podcast, as you can imagine, and most of them are we talk about some pretty deep stuff. But it seems to me that there is a huge amount of, so for example, I'll give you an example. John Okito, who is a former New Zealand rugby player. He's not being picked at the moment, but he plays for Worcester Warriors in the English Premiership, and he was in season one. And he had a experience in his past, which at the age of 9 years old, his dad, I think it was not between 9 and 13, his dad repeatedly pulled him off the rugby pitch and wouldn't, when he made a mistake, and wouldn't pick, and wouldn't speak to him on the, in the way, on the way back in the car. Now, this for Jono, basically he felt that every time he made a mistake, that his dad didn't love him, because he wasn't showing him the right, he just didn't feel that. Now, this then spiraled into this perfectionist complex, which caused Jono to be suicidal. I felt that in recounting some of the people that I've spoken to, my own experiences of trauma in the past, it was very similar to psychodynamic therapy, in which a lot of people have to go back to their past to understand what's happened and reframe it, actually using CBT methods that you rightly come onto, which work for you in the past. I'm just wondering whether what I'm talking about and the people is slightly different to what you're getting at there.
I've no doubt at all that there are people, as with the example you've just given, who have formative experiences that are psychologically destructive and that weigh on them for a long, long time. I mean, enduringly, and that it is beneficial to address them. And as I've already said, there is certainly an important role in treating psychiatric disorder for the type of psychodynamic therapy that stresses the importance of relationships. But that, to me, isn't particularly abstruse point drawn from Freud. It's just relationships are important, and I don't feel that in the case of a mood disorder like depression or anxiety, certainly in case of some other psychiatric disorders like eating disorders, for example, in the case of a mood disorder, it's not necessary in the main to go back to one's early life and distant memories in order to in order to resolve them. Psychodynamic therapy, from my understanding of it, is premised on the notion that there is some unresolved conflict, perhaps with an authority figure early in life, which is actually true in the case of the rugby player. Forgive me, I don't follow sports, so I'm not familiar with this case. It certainly was true in the case of your interviewee, but it's not necessarily true. Is not necessarily true of depression, was certainly not true of me. I had an extremely happy childhood and a happy and successful life.
But that's where sorry to interrupt, that's where it's I think that the waters are quite murky here, because it was only 15, 20 minutes ago, we were talking about this kind of midlife crisis and the weighing on you of past relationships, which you felt hadn't meant that essentially you felt that you were a failure yourself, and the issue you had with, which was in any case unresolved in your past, with your father's death, amongst other things, which again drew you to feel like you were a failure. It seems like they're quite similar, though, in terms of here's a past experience, which I suppose in your model of the world and your experience of it, you drew a conclusion which wasn't the reality, but still was your reality.
Yeah. Yes. My sole point about the psychology of it is that it's not necessary to go back to your early life in order to order to get well.
Okay.
I had two courses of treatment, one with a psychodynamic therapist and one, which I describe in the book at length, with a clinical psychologist.
Dr. O'Connor,
Anne-Marie O'Connor. The first made me worse, the second made me better. And I attempt to describe as objectively as I can the these different approaches Both are forms of psychotherapy, but one I found was effective. And it's not just me as a former depressive who found it effective. The clinical evidence is there. The randomized controlled trials demonstrate that this form of psychological therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and allied approaches, which I also describe in the book, works better than placebo. Yep. For most sufferers, not everyone, but for most sufferers. And the clinical evidence for psychodynamic therapy in the treatment of depression, there are other psychiatric disorders where the evidence is stronger, but in the treatment of depression is just not there. And that difference is important. There are a lot of depression memoirs that stress beneficial, commonsensical advice, such as go for walks, be physically active, enjoy nature, go swimming. These are all good things to do. My contribution, as it were, to this discussion is, yes, these are all things, good things to do, but don't feel that the science-based approach of drugs and talking therapy is somehow a sign of weakness. On the contrary, there's good evidence behind modern scientific evidence-based approaches to mental disorder. And the autobiographical element in my book is to describe what it's like from the inside, both suffering depressive disorder and receiving these treatments, and also to give as objectively and authoritatively as I am able to a description of the methods and the theories behind these treatments, as well as ones of which I'm more critical, like psychodynamic therapy.
There's a section in the book called Depressive Catastrophes, which actually I thought was one of the most important parts of the book, because it's your attempt, and a very, very, very good attempt as well, by the way, to make sense of it all. There's one passage in there which I loved, which was, I've written it down. Depression is a twisted kind of thinking. A cycle of isolation and of destructive thoughts feed on itself and intensifies the severity of the depression, and it's a recognizable state. Your twisted thinking, in which you talk about the destructive ways of thinking, was like another passage here, interrogating the beliefs that had caused my mental collapse and replacing them with better ones. Could you just touch upon the beliefs that were causing your mental collapse and how they became twisted? Because people listening to this who are going to be helped by this podcast are going to want to probably feel like they're not alone in what they're thinking. And then I want to come on to the ways in which you got over those destructive thoughts.
Yes, there are a number of symptoms of clinical depression. Early in the book, I define depression and indicate what in the medical literature these symptoms are. But one very salient symptom, which was certainly overwhelming in my case, is a sense of shame and of guilt. And because of the disappointments and failures that I had implemented, as it were, in my life, the fact that I was that I blamed myself for marital breakup and relationship difficulties, and that I didn't feel my standard of parental care was good enough. Self-criticism, which was undoubtedly justified, fed on itself in such a way that I became convinced that I was not merely imperfect and flawed, but evil. And the essence of depression of clinical depression is that you're I define it in the book as the reverse of solipsism. A solipsist believes that nothing in the universe exists except oneself. Well, a sort of reverse of that is to believe that the most evil characteristic of the universe is oneself, that nothing exceeds it, that you know, we are all flawed beings, and some of us are more flawed than others. But in the case of, let's say, a marital breakup or a relationship failure, in any adult relationship, there is always another side to the story. There is never a monopoly of responsibility, not usually a monopoly of failure. What I refer to as the catastrophizing mind is an interpretation of a set of facts in one's life that are all internally consistent, that make sense as a narrative, yet the interpretation goes to extremes of self-castigation and self-blame, to the extent of believing that there is no one more evil in the world than oneself, and nothing more cankered than one's personality. The essence of evidence-based psychological therapy is that you can't reason your way out of this sort of state. That's the first point, because reasoning is how you got into it in the first place.
Yes.
But also, it's not the events themselves that cause the depression. We all have disappointments and thwarted ambitions and failures and sadnesses and grief in life. We all do. That's part of the stuff of life. It isn't those events themselves that precipitate clinical depression, though they may, in fact, they will produce sadness of a more conventional kind. What precipitates clinical depression is the weight of the interpretations we put on these events. And this is the great insight of the type of talking therapy known as cognitive behavioral therapy, which was developed by an American psychiatrist called Aaron Beck, who is now well into his 90s, who was originally an advocate of psychoanalysis, of the type of approach theorized by Freud, and who attempted to put it on a scientific footing. Well, he did put therapy on a scientific footing, but of a somewhat different kind. The type of approach that addresses the defects in thinking and attempts to replace them with better ways of thinking, more constructive ways of thinking, not Pollyanna-ish wishful thinking, which just wouldn't be effective, but a process of interrogation between the therapist and the depressive and the sufferer, to test the catastrophizing thoughts and replace them with ones that are still plausible but more constructive. The clinical evidence is strong that this actually is effective in dealing with depression. My experience of it was certainly very beneficial.
Can you give me an example of a catastrophizing thought, destructive thought, which Dr. O'Connor was sat in front of you listening to, and then her interrogating riposte, which slightly altered your thought process, and embedded a new thought process which you could constantly challenge and take on as I suppose the new verbatim. Like what's an example?
Yeah, I can give you a very simple example. I was extremely fortunate in many, many ways in my experience of depression, both because I had treatment and because I had support from my employer. But also I had close friends and friends who were so concerned for my welfare that they would have me to stay for part of every week so they could look after me. One week I didn't go to see them and didn't get in touch with them. And the reason that I didn't was that I was convinced not only that I was evil, but that everyone knew this.
Yes.
And that my friends knew it too. And therefore I didn't get in touch with them. And they, not hearing from me, then didn't get in touch with me. And I interpreted this silence on their part as a confirmation that my wickedness was obvious and well known, even to those who were so kind as to take me in and to look after me. I was convinced that my wickedness was obvious. I recounted this to Dr. O'Connor, who psychological therapy doesn't involve the common sense response, but that's just silly. Don't be silly. And she didn't give it. She merely listened to my explanation of why I had been completely isolated in the course of the week and suggested that one possibility my friends had not been in touch was that I hadn't been in touch with them myself, and they had assumed that I wanted to be alone with my grief. And this suggestion that my isolation might have been due not to a universal knowledge that I was evil, but to a decision by my friends that perhaps I just wanted to be left alone for a little while, this suggestion slightly shifted my interpretation of that isolation. Of course, she was right, but it didn't seem to me in my depressive state that this was correct. Yet merely introducing this qualification, this suggestion that the facts were capable of being interpreted slightly differently, made me shift slightly away from my catastrophizing instinct. Now, that's a very simple example of a belief that I had that seemed completely rational to me, belief that I had that was obviously false, but was completely rational, and that I interpreted the facts in such a way to make them fit this narrative. It was wrong, but it seemed completely rational to me. It wouldn't have worked if she'd simply said, "But that's silly. Your friends obviously don't think that." And it wouldn't have worked if she'd said, "Well, I'm sure that's not correct." But she suggested an alternative way of interpreting the same facts. And this constant testing of the evidence for one's beliefs is how this form of psychological therapy proceeds. I say in the book, it's not like Freud delving into past memories. It is more like Socrates constantly testing and debating the evidence for facts now, not in the past, but facts now, to help one cope better with day-to-day existence.
How hard was that? Because you talk about, actually, it was really, really quite difficult. It seemed from the book, there's a bit in the book towards the end where you're talking about how you went to see your children over in another country. And this scene in this airport where you had to sit down and stop everything.
Sick. Yes, yeah. Yes. It was extremely difficult. My depressive state was very, very severe. There are different types of depression, and there are different levels of severity of depression. What's known as mild depression is dysthymia is a little bit of a misnomer, because that adjective might suggest that it's as a depressive state, it doesn't really matter. It does matter a lot. It's far worse than an irritant. It's a debilitating condition to have because it's always there. But my depression was very severe, and getting out of it took a long time, a lot of effort, and sometimes there was just no question. Some days, some bad days, there was no question of getting anywhere close to this model of rationality that I had always sought earlier in my life and that I aspired to when I was in my depressive state. And in those circumstances, on very bad days, there is just nothing you can do in terms of trying to test bad beliefs against the available evidence. You've just got to adopt other approaches. I refer to them in my book, one called compassion-focused therapy, which is CFT, yeah. just to be compassionate to oneself and to accept that you're not going to get out of this in the short term. You're not going to, certainly not going to reason your way out of it. You're going to have to feel your way out of it. And it's going to take a long time. And in those circumstances, the only thing one can do is to imagine things that are warmer, that are better, to take care of oneself in a direct physical sense. Make sure you shower, make sure you shave, make sure you're not subject to physical discomfort, take walks, do what you can, and know that however far you fall, and you will fall, it's never to quite the same state. It's going to be to a higher plateau each time. And this was how I reasoned to myself on my very worst days and my very worst nights, because the nights were very bad indeed.
Why were the nights so bad?
The nights were bad. I had a very severe problem of not being able to sleep. I took sedatives, which did help most of the time, but you can't take them consistently.
No.
I couldn't take them consistently for fear of being hooked on them, which was the last thing I needed in that condition. But the nights were bad because I would find it very difficult to sleep, and my demons would come calling in the middle of the night. I would feel especially lonely in those times.
What were the demons? What were the demons? Because you refer to them a few times, and I want to imagine them. I want to just understand them better. It's fascinating.
Yes, the demons were. I did hear voices.
Do you think it was your voice or somebody else's? Because earlier this year, obviously, we spoke about how I was suffering from severe depression and suicide, and the voice in my head was I couldn't quite work out whether it was mine or my own, but it was so loud, it was ringing. Every single minute of every single day, you're a failure, not good enough. This is just, what's the point? Mm. What was it, your voice?
No, it wasn't my voice. That was why it was so confusing to me. There are cases of depression, severe depression, that are psychotic. A psychotic illness is where, to put it neutrally, the world looks differently to you from the way it does to everyone else. And one aspect of psychosis is to hear voices, and there were times in my depression when it at least verged on the psychotic, because I did hear voices. I knew intellectually they couldn't exist, that no one else could hear them, but I could, in inverted commas, hear them. And there is I refer in the book to a very poignant literary characterization of them by Evelyn Waugh in his short novel The Ordeal of Gilbert Pinfold, who imagines mocking, derisive voices as he is on a cruise ship. He imagines these voices. They're drug-induced, in fact, but he imagines these voices. But they seem very, very clear to him, and they seem very clear to me. And Forgive me, I can't remember what your question was, but I did hear these voices.
And what were the demons? We digressed the onto voices, which are just as important, actually, because a lot of people found
the demons were this conviction that I had failed everyone who looked to me, that not only was this a council of failure, but an indication of wickedness, that it was not just an indication that life had lost its meaning, but that all of life, retrospective as well as current, was tarnished this way. And in addition, there were these voices that told me so. Mm. Those are the demons. The conviction that life as I had known, not just that life as I had known it was no longer pleasurable, but that it was futile and always had been, and that I was having this impressed upon me by disincarnate beings that I could not see, yes. that I knew did not really exist, but that I could hear.
Mm. Suicide ideation was pretty real for you, as it has been for me, and it's very, very common, actually. I've in the people I've spoken to, I had a guy called Nick Ead, who's a television presenter, on the podcast last week, who talks about how for 20 years now he's had not constant, but suicidal thoughts that come up, and mm-hmm. which he's normalized. Suicide ideation for you, what was it like? How did you experience it? And as somebody who was of sane mind, want of a better phrase, it must have been, I suppose, terrifying, but then became normalizing.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's well put. I when I became ill, I had no thoughts of self-harm. And when I phoned a counselling hotline, I was quite surprised, which put me in touch with the first psychotherapist. I was quite surprised to have the question asked. But the thought of suicide became constant. I had no intention of ever acting upon it. I did recall a school friend had killed himself, taken his own life when we were 16, and I recall very well the consequences for his family of that, and I did always recall that, and would never have wished to put those I love to the same distress. But I thought about suicide all the time, some days.
What were you thinking
about? In a sort of perverse form of rationality, I wanted to know if there was a way out of this veil of tears that was easy and painless, because I suppose I'm inherently cowardly in that way. And there was one day when I was supposed to be working on the proofs of a book I had written, not on the subject at all, but about language, and I just couldn't get down to it. I spent the day, there was that day in the news, a prominent suicide of a criminal. And I just couldn't stop thinking about it. So I spent the day browsing suicide websites. The reason I wanted to know about this was I believed that if I could find out there was a painless way of taking one's life, I believed that this would somehow calm the mental turmoil I was experiencing. And I must stress, first, that there is no such method. And second, that browsing these websites certainly did not have that effect at all. I became far more agitated and distressed. Mentally in even greater mental turmoil by the end of the day than I was during it. But this was a constant thought. There was no thought in my mind of self-harm. no thought in my mind of acting upon these thoughts, but the thoughts were there constantly.
There's a wonderful passage in the book when we get onto into the latter stages of the book where you're talking about the depression lifting and it being almost like this profound experience. I think it was in a train station.
It was on a bus.
It was on the bus by Shoreditch Church. That's right.
That's right.
Describe to me what that felt like. This moment where almost like the sun splits the clouds and shines upon you
I don't wish to make it sound sort of too dramatic or engage in cliches of recovery. It wasn't dramatic. I happened to be on a bus one day, getting the bus home from the Times offices, which are at London Bridge, and I lived at the time in East London. And as the bus passed the slightly shabby but very elegant facade, Palladian facade of Shoreditch Church in East London, I quite suddenly had a feeling not of peace, not of recovery, not of anything as dramatic as that, but of recollection. I could quite suddenly remember what it felt like not to have depression and that one could look forward to other things. So it wasn't dramatic. It wasn't a recovery. It was just a very slight shifting of my mental state that suggested to me that this weight of depression was not monolithic. It could be inched back, not pushed back, inched back, and that perhaps it was already in infinitesimally small stages lifting already. And I say in the book, it felt like someone had reached out a hand through the gloom and clasped my own before withdrawing. To a religious person, which I'm not, I would imagine it might have felt like an act of grace. That's the sort of analogy I can draw. It was a very small shift, but it was important. And I told my friends about it, and I told Dr. O'Connor about it. And it was at that point, as I say, it wasn't dramatic, but it was a sort of turning point.
Yes.
Because for the first time, I could recall what it was like not to have depression. I could envisage what it might be like in future not to have depression. And that thought stayed in my mind.
There's a piece in there as well, a strategy for recovery, which is all about emailing people to see them and then the middle of the night reassurement of your demons and saying there's really nothing you can do about it right now, but it is okay. How lengthy was the recovery?
The recovery, I was very severely ill for a year, and the illness persisted for a while longer in a less severe state. I would say that probably the recovery all told took a year, from very severe depression to a slightly monolithic state, less monolithic state, and then to not my normal self, but a new normal in which I wasn't quite the same sort of person I had been before. And I like to think my mental processes are more healthy than they were.
What is the new normal, Oliver?
The new normal is not, if I have a disappointment, is not to interpret it in the most catastrophizing way I can. I have doubts. I have setbacks. I have certainly have failings as well as failures, but no longer to interpret things in so extreme a way that they are irremediable, and no longer to fear the worst. No longer to fear the worst. And there are, as you refer to, there are strategies one can adopt in this state of severe depression just to help one cope, to help one cope. And if you're afflicted with, not just with doubt, but with mental disturbance, and desperately want to find out the answers, which I did. The best thing to do if you wake in the middle of the night trying to work out why you're in this state is not to try and think your way through it, because no answer is immediately available and you'll just reason your way into a deeper pit. It is to tell yourself that maybe the question needs to be answered, but not right now, not now, because it's not helpful. It's not helpful to keep thinking about it. Put it off to the next day or the next weekend or the next week. And even now, when I'm neurologically normal, typical, and have made a full recovery from depression, two things. First, I will know if I ever do slip back into that state, which, as you so rightly observe, people can and do. If I ever do slip back into that state, I will know how to deal with it. Mm. And second, even now when I'm when I can reasonably say I'm cured from depression, and the ability to practice psychological techniques is to me the equivalent of a cure. Even now, when there's something troubling me that has no answer, immediate answer, and I wake up in the middle of the night worrying about it, whether professional or personal, I tell myself, well, maybe it's important to know the answer, but there's no answer to be had right now, so it's not helpful to reflect upon it. Let's put it to one side. Let's think about it tomorrow. Let's think about it next week, but not now.
Do you have that conversation with yourself in your mind or on paper?
In my mind. Okay. I do think about it quite a lot. The sort of psychological techniques that were gently impressed upon me, I have found not just beneficial for dealing with my severe illness that I now have recovered from, but for handling life more generally. To that extent, the clinical psychologist, Dr. O'Connor, did stress to me in the many sessions we had that the aim was not to return to normal, but a new normal where, if these thoughts recurred, then I would know how to deal with them. And I would never have wished to go through depression, and I would never wish such suffering on anyone. But the experience of recovery was beneficial for my life in general, and not just for my not just for my emergence of illness.
How did you find that this podcast is all about men talking about their emotions, their issues, their problems, and as we spoke about before we started recording, diving deep into the psychology, deep intricacies, etc. Your experience of talking to your peers, your colleagues, your friends, the people around you about your illness. What was that experience like? Was there trepidation? Was there hesitation? Was it a difficult thing to I suppose reconciling yourself before you actually went and reconciled it with the world, as you're doing now with this book?
Yes, it was very difficult. It was very difficult to talk to people, not least because one of the aspects of my depression was a constant susceptibility to tearfulness. And I did not want to go to the managing editor's office at the Times and burst into tears. I should say, and I do stress in a book, that I was fantastically fortunate with my employer. Many people who suffer from clinical depression, I mean, I would say almost certainly the great majority, do not have the benefits that I did of friends and family who were supportive and an employer that was supportive. Clinical depression takes a heavy toll on personal relationships and professional life, and I was immensely fortunate. But facing up to the problem that I had, talking about it was very difficult because I did not wish to convey the extremity of these emotions, and I'd be tearful, and it was hard.
Interesting. I've got five questions that I'd like to finish on that I finish with everybody.
Yes, sure.
So I'm hoping these, I just want to get them up actually. Here we go. Sir. Number one, what's your favorite book and why?
My favorite book is one I cite in my book, which is Middlemarch by George Eliot, which seems to me the greatest of English novels. And it expressed to me the character of love, not to be sentimental about this. It demonstrated to me how the character of romantic love requires not just an initial coup de foudre, a burst of the heart, but a recognition of the real qualities, a recognition and esteem for the real qualities of the loved one. It seems to me a psychologically as well as historically outstanding novel.
Interesting. Very interesting. Number two, and this question stumps quite a few people, ask it anyway. What lesson have you learnt in your life that you know is true, but you kind of hate?
Yes, that is a good question.
I'm paid to ask them,
but I can answer it. It's one that my mother taught me when I was in my teens. I was quite an obnoxious teenager, and one of the facets in which one of the ways in which I expressed this was I wasn't particularly pleasant to my teachers. And my mother has said to me once, so she was a great admirer of Jane Austen. She must have been thinking of Emma's rudeness to Miss Bates, the rather irritating and dull Miss Bates. My mother said to me once, you know, if you can use words fluently, it's very easy to use them to wound. And you must never do that. You must never do that. That was how... I've always followed that advice, but it is correct. And it's a lesson in life that I need constantly to remind myself of, both personally and professionally.
I like that. I haven't had that one before. Very interesting. Your friend who's having a tough time at the moment picks up the phone, he rings you and says he's having a really bad day today. What do you say?
I say, tell me about it. And I have, since I went public with my depression, I have had friends and acquaintances who have contacted me saying exactly that. And what I attempt to do is to listen to them and, to the extent that I'm able to reassure them that how they interpret what they tell me, it's not as dark as they suggest. And if they are in a condition that I think is clinical, then I will reassure them that the treatments are there. I may not be able to give them, but the treatments are there. There is always help.
Okay, very nice. Good advice. Number four, when you're struggling with something, struggling yourself, what's your go-to to improve things? What do you do?
If I'm struggling, my first instinct is just to stop and take a walk. I don't find inspiration to resolve it in bucolic idylls or Clapham Common, where I'm next to at the moment, is hardly a bucolic idyll. It's a muddy morass after recent days. But I take a walk, I stop, and I come back to it. But also, if I've got mounds of work piling up, which I'm very fortunate to have at the moment, whereas lots of other people are worried for their livelihoods and their jobs in these times of crisis. But if I have a lot of tasks ahead of me, I don't particularly worry about it. I just sit down and get on with it. Because I'm a writer and my work depends on the words I put down on the page, my philosophy is it's easier to take words out than it is to put them down. So just get on with it and put them down and worry about their coherence later.
Mm. Yep. Very true. Number five and last question. You're lying on your deathbed looking back at your life. Slightly morbid, I know, but it's a good question nonetheless. What are you most proud of?
I'm most proud of leaving a body of work that I hope will be beneficial to those who come after me. I'm most proud of having given advice that I hope will be helpful to those I love.
Very nice. Very nice. Special thanks, actually, to Lord Daniel Finkelstein, a colleague of yours, a family friend of mine, who's
one of my closest friends.
Yeah, yes. Who's put us in touch, and I'm very, very glad we've got the opportunity finally after about four reschedules.
that's right. I much apologise for that. We've been
on both of our parts,
lockdown
yeah.
as well.
We have, yeah.
We were disrupted by lockdown.
We were supposed to sit down in person, and I was going to come to your lovely flat.
We're unable to do that.
But we were unable to do that. So I'm very, very pleased we got to sit down over Zoom. But I just want to thank Danny for introducing us. And secondly, Oliver, thank you for being so open. It's what you experienced is horrendous, but unfortunately, all too common at the moment. With the general public, and I think that coming from the background in terms of your professional life and now your personal life that you do, it's going to be very, very heartening for people to listen to this, watch it when it goes up on YouTube, etc., and clips of it will go up on social media. To see you being so open about your condition is one which touches a lot of hearts, both from sufferers and people who know sufferers. I just want to thank you for being so open and talking about it.
James, it's been a pleasure, and thank you very much for inviting me on.
Last thing as well, the book, where can people find it? Mending the Mind, out January the 7th. Where can people find it, and where can people find you as well?
That's right. The book is titled Mending the Mind, The Art and Science of Overcoming Clinical Depression. It's published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson on the 7th of January. If you go to my profile on Twitter, which is Oliver Cam, there is a link where you can pre-order the book from a number of fine retailers, Amazon, Waterstones, and others in print, in ebook, or in audiobook form. So there is a range of formats for you.
Who's speaking the version?
The audiobook is read. In fact, on the audiobook, I read the preface and the epilogue. But the bulk of the book, the rest of the book, is read by an actor, Roger May, who is very experienced in narrating audiobooks and whose voice I found while I was listening to him do it almost hypnotic. It's really he's a very fine declaimer.
Fantastic. Oliver Camp, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, James. Thanks. Bye now.
Bye. Oliver's book can be bought on Amazon and through his publishers, I think. But I think you can get it in most good bookshops. Obviously you can't go to a bookshop at the moment, but you can find it on Amazon. Mending the Mind, The Art and Science of Treating Clinical Depression. I will also put links to it in the show notes, as well as his social media, which is actually quite interesting if you're interested in politics and the economy. Do give him a follow. I just wanted to quickly recap really on that episode, because it's I did a similar one with Alistair Campbell a few episodes ago for season two, in which we discussed his new book coming out. Oliver's pursuit of finding answers has, I think, been critical in the success of A, his book, but also his mending and healing process. I think what this episode typifies as well and clarifies for me is the fact that improving your mental health is not a one-size-fits-all procedure, which is why I think this area is so complex. Interesting, and often quite daunting in equal measure. Oliver's persistence in finding the right therapist for him was key, actually, in his guide to mending his mind. Mending his mind was a long, arduous, painful, and often very teary process, but he did it. He's back to his best. However, it takes work, hard work to do that. I think that's what resonated so much with me. Improving your mental health takes a lot of work. You must take responsibility in some way, shape, or form for it, and you should be ready to explore it as well. But it gets better, as does next week's episode with Sky Sports and Blue Peter presenter Simon Thomas. See you next week.